This episode contains descriptions of violence and graphic descriptions of injuries and surgery. Listener discretion is advised.
That was an interesting thing. So I'm at the zoo for the first time, right? And the first time I saw a bear again, the bear was gnawing on a big bone, which is like, oh God, that could be my head, right? That was a little weird.
Johan Otter grew up in the Netherlands and met his wife, Marilyn, while working as a physical therapist at San Gabriel Valley Medical Center, just outside of Los Angeles. He loves running and keeps very unconventional hours. He gets up and is out for his daily run around 3 a.m. He and Marilyn and their two daughters, Jenna and Stephanie, would often go on hiking vacations.
I'm originally from the Netherlands, right? And you don't have a lot of nature back there. You don't have big animals. It's different environment, incredibly urban. And of course, the Western United States is not. So when the youngest one was old enough, we started traveling and doing hikes and going to Yellowstone, Grand Tetons, any of the parks that we have in California. And the West Coast is just amazing, right? And so from then on, so Jenna basically at a young age learned, you know, to appreciate nature. The two of us were always more interested in seeing what's beyond the next curve, basically, more so than my wife and my younger daughter. That's kind of how it all came to be. And then for high school graduation, obviously, Jenna wanted to do more hiking with me, to get beyond the mountain, see what's behind it.
So the August after Jenna's high school graduation in 2005, they went on a trip to Glacier National Park in Montana.
We'd been there once before, and we knew how beautiful it was. So when we went to dinner the night before, we walked by a rather large black bear, and I would say 20, 30 feet, but everyone else was as well. So you're kind of like, must be okay, right?
Yeah, he's a city bear.
Of course. That's in nature, but it's like, well, it's just a black bear. It's not going to do anything.
So being such like an experienced hiker and traveler, how much did you know about bear safety going into this trip?
I would say just like any tourists, right? I mean, luckily both Jenna and myself were the kind of people who read the instructions. You know, it's like, okay, there's bears around here. I mean, and we still had this, you have this romanticized idea about wildlife. We think about nature as a big zoo. They're not going to attack us. Nothing's going to happen. You know, that kind of stuff. It's a weird city person type of mindset, I think, that obviously.
It's very like Disney animals.
Yeah. And if you would have asked me that prior to our experience, it would say, oh, of course not. You know, no, I truly understand all that.
Seeing a bear that close energized Johan for the hike the next day. He wanted to be out on the trail before anyone else, to see it at its most pristine.
And so it's a beautiful trail, and there's a lot of beaver evidence, and it's just fascinating. It was just, I would say, an idyllic setting, just amazing. And after you go through the quote-unquote forest, you get above the larger trees, basically. You get closer to the tree line. And then the environment opens up and the views are amazing. In the meantime, there was a golden eagle flying overhead. And of course, I'm all into that. I want to film it. And Jenna's like, come on, Dad, we really have to keep going. So I'm like, okay.
They wanted to do another trail in the afternoon, so there was no time to dawdle.
And I have everything on me, of course, because I'm the dad and I have to be the mule, basically, that packs everything. So Jenna's ahead of me. And now we're getting into our serious hiking because we need to finish this trail. And we're halfway up the more barren part of the trail on the way. And the left side of you, it's a steep drop. I mean, maybe 1,000 feet, it's steep. It's a couple of rocks in between, basically. And then on the right, there's a sheer cliff going up as well, and there's water dripping from it.
And how wide is the path at that point?
You can kind of stand two people next to one another, but you wouldn't want to walk that way because it would be kind of scary for the person on the left. Yeah. Okay. And when you go up, you know, when there's a rock sticking out, you can't really see around it, right? It just kind of it keeps your view away. And so Jenna goes around this rock and steps back and says something like, oh no, or whatever. And just the parental instinct, you know, sticks in. And so I naturally just stepped in front of whatever she was stepping away from to kind of like, okay, there's something there. I have no idea what it is. And the first thing I see is teeth and claws, basically. The first thought was like, oh, that's a mean old badger. Just, again, you're thinking about the largest predator we had in Holland at that point. It's like, okay, yeah, that's a nasty animal.
But it wasn't a badger. It was something way worse. A mama grizzly bear protecting her cubs. This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul.
It was between 0.2 and 0.7 of a second that actually something ran into me, basically. And what happened is the bear basically jumped forwards. It hit my eye and bit my upper thigh on the left side. And I'm not realizing what's happening at that point, but having to stand my ground because my daughter's behind me. And it's really where these things happen within split seconds. And the split seconds seem to last forever. That particular moment was when time stood still in a way. And it's the most bizarre thing. And it seems like everything's kind of moving through molasses, basically. Like, and then it's interrupted by really fast stuff as well. It's a really bizarre concept in a way. And then whatever it was hit me again in my thigh, bit me again. And then you're like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. It's like my whole front's exposed, right? I'm not in a fetal position the way I'm supposed to be. Of course, my bear spray's in my backpack somewhere. And so on the left side is a cliff, but there's kind of like this sticky outy thing and there's some bushes. And I think I can jump for that. Because if I stay standing here, I mean, the front's going to be ripped open and I'm going to be gone. So that's when I made the decision to basically just hurl myself off the cliff and go to the labyrinth about 25 feet down or so. I landed in the bushes. And then the time became normal again. And then you go from this really violent thing to nothing. This was really bizarre. So now it's like, okay, there's no noise, there's no nothing, there's no bear.
In the brief moment where Johan could assess what was happening, he immediately realized that if the bear didn't follow him, it was still on the trail with Jenna.
I need to get that animal back to me, or Jenna needs to go. What I didn't realize at that point, bear spray had actually fallen out of my backpack on the trail. And Jenna saw it and tried to pick it up, but didn't remember you had to pull the little plug back before you can spray it, basically. In the meantime, this bear is running at her. So whether she tripped, fainted, fell, or whatever, she doesn't necessarily recall, but she fell off the cliff way past me about 50 feet down onto a ledge. And so with that fall, she broke her back. Basically, she couldn't walk at that point. It was too painful, so she crawled behind the bush.
Johan couldn't let the bear follow Jenna, so he had to draw it toward himself.
So I called for the bear, basically, because I saw it above me. And just with my left eye, because I couldn't see on my right eye anymore. And I'd never seen anything move so fast from the trail on top of me. It was kind of one of the weird, you know, Spider-Man movies type of thing. It's like bizarre. But luckily at that point, I was able to get into the fetal position, protect my head. Bear was like pulling me up and down in my backpack. And another weird thing happening, besides the time was bizarre, is like your thoughts are kind of bizarre too. They don't necessarily match the danger of the environment. Because now I'm like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, interesting. It's like this animal is pulling me up and down in my backpack. That's really strong. Then the realization sets in, well, wait a minute, if that happens to Jenna, Jenna has no backpack because I have everything on me. It's going to rip her apart. So that's the decision then to, okay, this bear needs to stay, really needs to stay with me. I made another fall, but I hadn't realized I'd actually grabbed the bear by the scruff and pulled it down with me. And so we together fell about 30 feet down just a vertical chute. I landed on my back and I had a bear in my right hand.
On just like rock?
A rock. Solid rock. Yeah. And yet the falling was more comfortable than the attack. And so now I have a bear in my hand and the bear's looking at me and it's these two amber brown eyes. It's not dark brown, but it's amber brown eyes staring at me. I still remember seeing that. First, I thought, oh, maybe I can hit it with a rock. So I went with my left hand to grab for some rocks. Couldn't find anything that was a solid material, just dust, basically, because the shield really kind of just goes to dust when you touch it. And I'm like, can't throw dust in its face. That is really going to piss it off. And so I turned around again and put my hands again on my head. And this animal had now gotten incredibly mad at me. Truly tried to take my head off. It was jumping on me and I could feel things crack on the top of my back, so I knew stuff was breaking.
While the bear was attacking Johan, he had an out-of-body experience. Sort of.
But it's kind of bizarre how you remember all these details. And one of the things was when this bear was really on top of me, it kind of had the sensation as if I was watching myself. And someone said, oh my God, you had an out-of-body experience. I'm not sure about that stuff. You know, I'm not making anything off it, but I was definitely watching myself with this thing on top of me. And then I had this illusion as if I was a stuntman in a Hollywood movie. But the stuntman was getting injured. And don't those stuntmen normally not get injured? And so those thoughts were going through my mind as well. So you can see in a time frame of minutes, you have this fantasy stories and everything happening at the same time. Bizarre to experience that, quite honestly.
Yeah. It's almost like you have to be outside yourself to survive this thing.
Exactly. I had no pain, by the way. I could feel things, right? You could feel things, you know, biting you. I could feel things cracking in my neck. I knew that was painful, but that was just not a feeling that was going to be useful for me at that point.
This delusion that he was a stuntman didn't make the bear or the damage it was causing any less real.
And then it bit my head once really hard, and I could feel a tooth go in. Like, okay, still okay, still okay. And then it bit me again on the left side, and I really could feel a fang going into the bottom of my skull. And that's when I was like, okay, this is getting too bad. If this continues, it's really going to kill me. I can't do anything with Jen anymore. So that's when I ripped myself into loose from the animal and fell another 25 feet. And then with my feet on a rock, and I could sense there wasn't anything below me. It's a weird sense that you get to.
At this point, he's now fallen from the trail down 25 feet, then pulled the bear with him down another 30 feet, and was now standing on an extremely narrow cliff another 25 feet down. Luckily, the bear didn't jump down to Johan on the ledge. It seemed to be walking away, but then Johan heard a terrible noise.
And then truly the worst thing happened at that point is that it came across Jenna and I heard a scream. Sorry.
Take your time.
It's been 18 years. It still gets me. Because it's, I mean, you tried to protect your girl. You thought it the whole time. And it just wasn't enough. And then then I didn't hear anything. And so that was kind of scary for a moment, right?
Johan had done everything he could to protect his daughter, including throwing himself in front of the bear several times. He was just too far and too injured to draw the bear back again. He didn't hear anything for about a minute and a half.
So I called out. And that was a scary thing to have to do, by the way, because you kind of don't want to know the answer in a way, right? Because what if you hear nothing? But She up.
So,
you get the worst sound in the world and the best sound in the world in a 2 minute time frame. And that was just amazing. Oh my God, she's still alive. And then she basically said, so how are you? And it got me kind of bad. That's the only thing I said, like, that I was kind of injured. And then I said, Jenna, how are you? She said, I'm fine.
We're about to hear Johan describe their injuries. So if that's not something you want to hear, skip ahead about a minute and a half.
But I didn't realize she had her finger in a hole in her head. Because when the bear came across her and when she screamed, she kind of reached out her hands, kind of just what you would normally do, right? When something comes at you. And it bit her in the shoulder and pulled her open and bit her in the face and ripped open the bottom of her cheek. And so, with that bite on her cheek, but also a tooth going in the top of her skull. I mean, this is how big these mouths are. I mean, she had a big hole there, and she basically thought, I have to put a finger in there just in case it's bleeding. I need to stop the bleeding. So that was her condition. And then this whole weird, surreal thing comes back again. Like, oh, okay, I'm on the side of the mountain, and I can't see out of my right eye. Well, maybe it's hanging down my cheek. So I'm going up my cheek to see if my eye is hanging out, which is a weird concept to think about at that point. And then, okay, it's not hanging out. Well, maybe I can still see out of my eye. So I'm opening my eyelids and then, oh, I can see, and I can see the leg. Perfect. The rest I can fix with a little surgery. I'm not going to worry about that part. And then I'm feeling the strings hanging in front of my face. I'm like, what is this? And I'm like, oh my God, it looks like hair. And so it's basically with strings from my scalp hanging down. So I'm like, okay, so I'm feeling up with this bone. I'm like, oh, not good. And at that point I started yelling help, and then she started yelling help, and her help sounded like she had good lung power. So I'm like, oh great, I mean, it looks like she's doing okay.
While they were calling for help, Johan tried to clean himself up a bit. He knew how gruesome he must look and remembered a piece of advice he read in a book the previous day.
And I had a little nylon jacket in my backpack, which was still on. The camera was still hanging around my neck, by the way. And so I'm like, okay, I need to get this jacket out. Because, of course, the night before, I had read one of those books about, you know, the worst 100 attacks in the United States or something like that by bears. I mean, I'm a typical tourist. So I took the jacket out, and this person had done this herself to protect her head from a bear attack. I'm like, well, that's a good idea. So I did the same thing, because you're like, well, wait a minute, I'm going to look terrible if someone else sees me.
Yeah.
So I put the head of the jacket over my head, actually. And then remember what they tell you in the airplanes. If something bad happens, don't worry about your luggage and you get yourself out, right? So being a kind of a rule follower, I thought about that. It's like, okay, take the backpack off, take the camera off, and climb up and go to find Jenna. So I climbed up about the 25 feet back to the platform I had originally fallen to. And then I got a little woozy. I'm like, oh, no, this is not good. So I sat back down again. I said, okay, because really the next fall down, there was nothing there. It was 1,000. It was deaths, basically. It was just the way it was. Yeah, and it's kind of bizarre. Sorry if I think about it. This has been 18 years and I still remember every second of this, right?
And it was many seconds, many minutes until someone would find them.
So it took like 45 minutes just for one person to find you. What is your mind doing in those 45 minutes?
Yeah, good question. Because of course we're yelling here, right? Help. But yeah, during that time, you try to keep yourself comfortable. Although you may not have pain, you're still uncomfortable. And I just couldn't get comfort, right? And it's like, I couldn't lay down. That was just not comfortable for my head. If I sat up, I was just kind of woozy. So it's kind of just positioning yourself as best as you can. Keeping, you know, just at least vocal touch with my daughter. How are you doing? She's fine. Okay, good.
Finally, a couple of hikers heard their yells and came across Jenna. There was no cell phone service in the park, so one of the hikers ran to get more help. The other slid down the mountain to the landing where Johan was. He asked how he could make Johan more comfortable, and as more and more hikers came across the scene, they threw down jackets and sweaters to keep him warm and give him a makeshift pillow. Another group of hikers was with Jenna.
People are just so nice when others are in peril, right? I mean, you get a really good appreciation of humankind. I mean, we're always so nasty to watch ourselves in a way, but people truly are nice. It doesn't matter, you know, your backgrounds or anything like that. Didn't matter. We were people. And that was beautiful. These two girls came down to keep us comfort. And one of them stayed with Jenna, one of them stayed with me. And I started to shake at that point because I was just, I didn't realize I'd lost a lot of blood. Mm-hmm. And so one of them put her body on top of mine just to kind of keep me warm, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm dirty, right? Be careful. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it. It was just so nice. People were just amazing.
It was 2 hours before the rescue crew arrived. When they got there, Johan was so uncomfortable on the small cliff, he threatened to climb up the mountain to the trail himself if nobody would help him.
No, you can't move, you can't move. I'm like, nope, unless you help me up, I'm going to do it myself. So they had to help me because it was just too uncomfortable because I felt this big rock sticking in the back of my neck. Well, afterwards, I learned that I'd broken my neck in several spots, and that was probably what I was feeling, just the bones sticking into a different direction than they were supposed to. And then when the rangers came, of course, I mean, they then took over, right? And they were just incredible as well. I mean, the professionalism. It was Gary Moses and Katie, I think it was Clevenger, that was sitting at my head. And then you have Gary right next to me. And Gary told me later that he could not move backwards because he would have fallen off the cliff. I mean, so this is how precarious the situation still is. And they're trying to keep me comfortable. Now, that jacket I had put over my head had sealed down on my skull and could have possibly saved my life because you have two arteries going through there that were basically sealed shut, which is kind of cool, right? So they left that on, obviously. And they did put some fluid in me. Because my blood pressure was basically going down, down, down. And then when they put fluid in me, I started leaking everywhere. Basically, because I have wounds everywhere and they weren't leaking because I had lost so much blood and there was no fluid to leak out anymore. It's like, oh my gosh, you sprung leaks everywhere.
Even though Johan was literally leaking, he still kept his sense of humor.
And so then another ranger came, a female ranger, and she started to pull my pants off. and that's when I kind of became myself again. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Because Katie was kind of crying here. I mean, she was upset with what she was seeing at that point. Gary was holding himself, very professional man. And then this other ranger. And I needed to, in a way, you need to break the moment, right? I mean, there's humor everywhere, even in situations like that. And I basically said, when the woman started pulling my pants down, it's like, hey, have you folks ever seen Seinfeld, the series Seinfeld? And they're like, yeah. Kind of like, okay, what's this guy going for right
relevant?
Now? How is this at all relevant? Exactly. Yeah. I said, okay, have you ever watched that episode about George and Shrinkage? And they looked at me and they started laughing because they knew it. I said, okay, no assessment when you're pulling my pants down, okay? Because it's cold and I lost a lot of fluid.
While Johan was feeling more himself, the rangers still needed to get him to a hospital. A rescue team tried to attach hooks into the mountain wall to hoist Johan up from the ledge, but they couldn't find rock solid enough to hold the hooks. They had to attempt a risky helicopter rescue, where Johan would be secured to a stretcher, then a man on a rope would be lowered down by the helicopter. He would then secure the stretcher to the rope, and they would both be lifted, dangling below the helicopter and flown to a waiting ambulance.
And then the rescue was, of course, amazing. And just to kind of watch it. Gary Moses promised me the best view of my life. I didn't get any view. But you're hanging under a helicopter, basically. And there's a guy that sits right on top of you. And the guy called himself the dope on the rope. Just the nicest man, a flight nurse, I think. Just amazing that these people do that, right? That they themselves put themselves in jobs like that to help people like myself.
Yeah.
Everything that the people did, everyone on the trail, it was like a community effort to help someone. And actually, when the helicopter pilot, Ken, put me down, it was one of the best transfers I had ever. It's like, oh, it was nice and gentle. You know, Ken has become one of my best friends.
Once Johan was safely on the ground, the helicopter immediately went back to get Jenna. Johan waited in the ambulance for her.
So they asked me if it was okay to pick up Jenna. I'm like, well, duh. Yeah. It's like, you know, don't worry about me. Go get her. And they allowed me and Jenna to talk after they had pulled her down. And I basically said, Jenna, make sure you're the one that calls mom. Because she's going to be really mad at us. Yeah. Because now you start to think about all these other people around you, right? Because at least if my wife would hear my daughter's voice right away, she knew it wasn't anything bad going on with her.
Once Johan got to the hospital, doctors descended on him and got to work.
You end up from an environment of cold, gross, there's blood, there's water, there's crap everywhere, right?
Yes.
Into this pristine, beautiful, white environment with all these beautiful people in these white coats. Like, oh my God, I died and went to heaven, but I didn't really die, but I'm still in heaven right now. This is amazing. And I kept thanking everyone. Afterwards, one of the physicians had told me, you were one of our most thankful patients we've ever had. And they were just everyone, from the pilots of the fixed wing plane, the pilot of the helicopter. It's always hard to talk about those people that help you. Because you feel kind of guilty towards having, I'm sorry that I caused this. Caused it myself in a way, right? I'm so sorry about that. But yeah. But now do your job because you need to help me.
As much as Johan didn't want to be a burden, he was still gravely injured. The Montana hospital staff cleaned him up and stabilized him before he was flown to a hospital in Seattle that was better equipped to handle his injuries.
My whole scalp was gone, right? It was 80% gone, and that's exposed. And that's a risk for infection and death. And so that had to be fixed first. I had a huge open wound in my arm and some tendons were broken or torn. So that had to be fixed too. My eye, of course, needed to be fixed.
He also had a compound fracture on his C2 vertebra. In Johan's work as a physical therapist, he already knew what the options were.
I knew I didn't want surgery. I didn't want a fusion happen to my neck because that would make me stiff. So I had seen as a therapist, and once a fusion's done, then they have to do another fusion. And people just end up in this vicious circle of pain and more disability. Mm-hmm. It's much better if the body can heal itself and we don't fuse something. But sometimes you have no option because that's the only way, right? Luckily, I had the option of let it heal by itself.
Letting it heal by itself meant Johan would have to have his head and neck stabilized in a contraption called a halo. A halo is a crown-like ring that is attached to the head by pins drilled into the skull. Four bars attached to the ring on one end are also attached to a vest fitted to the torso so that the neck and the head are in a fixed position. If you've seen Mean Girls, the original, not the musical remake, Regina had a halo after getting hit by the bus.
So you can imagine I'm on pain medication at that point. I'm not doing that hot. And I'm being wheeled in. And at that point, maybe not treated like a person, more again, like a sack of potatoes, unfortunately. And I hear people talking around me. They're kind of explaining, just rogue explanation to me. And they start screwing these screws into my head. Well, a hand explained to me that when they do that, the pressure is going to be intense. It's going to feel as if your head is in a nutcracker. And I thought my head was going to like open up like a walnut, basically. and it's really intense. And I said, ow, this hurts a lot.
The doctors realized they had forgotten to give him any local anesthetics before they started drilling.
So they screwed the screws back out again, which, it hurts again. So they gave me some pain. And at least the superficial pain was gone. So you weren't just like screwing a screw into someone's skin without any anesthesia, basically. Because you still had a superficial feeling, regardless whether you're on pain meds or not.
Johan had to live in this contraption for 3 months.
So when people ask me that, I would say, well, what do you think? How do you think that would feel? And they say, oh, it would be terrible. I'm like, that's exactly how it is. It is just as bad as it looks like. Luckily, I was able to take a pain med in the morning. So then the first thing I would wake up was the pain med in the morning and then one during the day. So I kind of was in a little bit like, yeah, everything's okay type of land. But you need that when you're immobile like that. It feels terrible. Sleeping, you know, how do you sleep? Well, you can really only sleep on your back. And luckily, my wife was able to roll up some towels and put them on the sides. So the head was still, you know, supported.
Yeah.
A good thing, though, about this halo, which was secondary to just the immobilization of your neck, was the fact that I couldn't put pressure on this big graft they put on my head, right? Because they had to take a muscle out of my sides, cut it to size, and then slap that on top of my head, basically, to create a new... A new head.
Just the slapping on top of your head. I'm sorry.
It was a really good looking steak. Let's say that way. That's what they took out. And yeah, it seems so like, yeah, gross, but it's not.
As you'll hear, I strongly disagree that it's not gross. And if you're squeamish at all, I would recommend skipping ahead about 2 minutes this time. Before he even got the halo, Johan went through multiple surgeries to handle the rest of his injuries.
And the nice thing about this muscle they took out is called the latissimus dorsi, right? It's the muscle that you use for pull-ups and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It has its own vein and artery, and they can connect that to a vein and artery right here.
Johan is pointing to his temple.
And so it's just a beautiful way of thinking about this, and they use that muscle a lot for other things too, and people, you know, lose other body parts because of cancer and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just ingenious the way they do it. Of course, it's a very delicate surgery. I mean, I'm talking about you slap it on you. It's a little bit more than that.
Sure, I imagine. So does that grow back?
No. Yeah, you just missed that.
Oh no, we can't do pull-ups.
Yeah, I could never do them anyway, so I'm not gonna miss that. Yeah, it took it from my right thigh. Actually, that was the most painful thing, to shave it off. Yeah, think about that. Yeah.
Oh.
It's like you take basically a cheese slice and...
Oh, no, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
So then you just have like another gaping wound.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And that was incredibly uncomfortable. And they make a mesh out of the skin, they put it on top of your head, and you have that sitting on top of the slab of meat that you got at the side of your body. It's amazing what we can do in medicine.
It is truly amazing. It is also really gross.
Meanwhile, Jenna was still back in Montana, being treated at Kalispell Hospital.
Jenna would update me, obviously. And so she had to wear a turtle shell because she needed to keep her fracture stabilized, basically in her back, and then she was able to take that off afterwards. Her mouth was torn open and did surgery in Kalispell. And, you know, this is always our thinking, right, in like the big city. So at San Diego, we're like, well... Let her go to a quote-unquote real plastic surgeon and see what job they did. Well, she went to one of our best plastic surgeons, Dr. Silver, and he looked at her. He's like, they did such a beautiful job. I couldn't have done it better. Which is just such a compliment to the folks that we were taking care of in Montana, right? So Jenna's recovery was, actually pretty good.
While he was thrilled about Jenna's recovery, Johan was having a hard time mentally dealing with his own.
So after all the surgeries had done, I couldn't move, right? My everything is bandaged. My head is in a vice. and you just want to go to sleep and get through it. And you're in an ICU, and ICUs are noisy, and so it's not conducive for sleeping. And my worst device was the clock on the wall. It was a torture device, because I thought I'd slept, and I looked at the clock, and it only had moved maybe 15 minutes. And it felt like, you know, minutes lasted hours, hours lasted days. It was the worst time in my life was to be in an ICU like that. And I started to panic. And you get these semi-panic attacks. Actually, the mental journey is much tougher than the physical journey, right? The physical journey you can see, and the mental journey you can't see. And yeah, besides, of course, the initial panic attacks and such, I did have a psychiatrist come to me and said, you know, you're going to get post-traumatic stress, and you may want to take something for it, right? And I took something, and it made me completely feel depressed. And I actually told him, like, I don't like what you just gave me. He's like, well, let's take it off. You don't have to take any meds right now. We'll see how it goes. And that's the only time I had any professional come talk to me that way, basically. My wife recognized it. The nurse that was with me recognized it. That nurse actually stayed with me an extra shift. So imagine this. You're staying with your patient for 24 hours. That's amazing. The kind of care I was getting was just beautiful. You know, people really caring about people. I mean, I work in a healthcare organization, right? I work at Scripps in San Diego, and the CEO and the chief medical officer and one of the other big chiefs in the organization, they had flown down to come see me. Think about how special is that, right? And that does give you an extra willpower that you really need through these kind of episodes. Really need that, like, support.
During this visit, Johan also found out that his insurance was paying to fly him back to San Diego, where he would continue to heal at Scripps Memorial Hospital, where he worked. This was a huge relief to Johan to be going home. Not only would he be in a familiar environment, but he would get to see his other daughter, Stephanie, for the first time since the attack.
I mean, emotional, right? Because it's like, this is the kid. I mean, because they're, and still to this day, they say, how's your daughter? They always mean Jenna. They don't mean Stephanie. It's like, well, I got two. Which one do you talk? Which one do you mean? But I know what they mean. I'm not going to be mean. But it was, of course, that was emotional too. And luckily, I was able to see her, of course, when I got back to the hospital in La Jolla. And the interesting thing is, you find out who your real friends are, and I have so many real friends. It's amazing. And one of them called me and asked me, what can I do? And I said, you know, I need some help because Steffi just turned 16. I need to get a car for her, and I can't go out. And I know you've been a car dealer before. Can you help out? Oh, they helped out. When I got home from the hospital, Tom gave me a call and said, hey, is she like blue? I said, I don't know, for what? It's like, for a car. I'm like, I don't know, let me ask. And so I asked, hey, Stephanie, do you like blue? She's like, for what? I'm like, for a car. I'm like, sure. Tom says, I'm on my way with the dealer. The guy bought me a car for my daughter. Just like, he just had more joy in giving that to us than anything. It just gave him such joy that he was able to do that for one of his friends, which is, amazing. And so all these people, you know, and you're really good friends with them, but you don't know how good you actually have with these people. You need to really appreciate everyone around you, right?
After 3 incredibly uncomfortable months of bad sleep, Johan was finally healed enough to get the halo off. But not having this big contraption on him presented another set of challenges.
So when you walk around with a halo, everyone walks around you with a big, you know, they don't dare to come too close to you, which is wonderful because you don't want to be touched or you want to be bumped into.
Right.
After the halo came off, there was no physical obvious sign that there was something wrong with me. And that's also when the whole flood of emotions came to me, what had actually happened. And what I had also done, and this was my mistake, I'd taken myself off any pain meds. I'm like, okay, the halo's off. I don't need that anymore. So, of course, I had this kind of like this down type of feeling was because I took myself off all the pain meds. And luckily my boss is, you know, what are you doing? Put yourself back on the medication. You need to temper everything. You don't just do that. I'm like, okay. But that was probably the hardest time, is when once you finally physically kind of look normal again, and now you had to be normal, but you weren't yet. That was probably the hardest time.
While in the halo, Johan had a lot of time to think about what he wanted to do once it came off.
I had three different goals after all this had settled down with me. And one of them was, physically, I need to get back to the level that I was before. Like I said before, as a patient, you want to be normal. You don't want to be anything exceptional. You want to be normal. Well, what is your norm, right?
Normal for Johan was qualifying for the Boston Marathon. The qualifying time for his age group in 2006 was 3 hours and 30 minutes.
And then my second one is, I had an educational goal. I really wanted to get my doctorate in physical therapy. I did that. And it's hard, right? When you start something, it's like, oh, dude, I'm looking at 3 years of going to school again. Why? Well, I just wanted to do it. Just do it, right? And then my other goal was professionally and being part of an executive team at our hospital, which was a little hard because there's not a lot of people other than physicians and nurses that make it into the executive realm, MBAs maybe, but not PT. So I'm like, I'm going to do that. And so actually, that was the easiest. The hardest was the physical thing.
Before the attack, Johan was an experienced marathon runner. But now he had to start training from square one.
So how was taking that first run? And did that feel encouraging or discouraging?
Oh, very discouraging. So, you know, once you can run marathons, right, you don't think about running a couple of miles, it's nothing. And I ran, I think, 20 steps, and I was exhausted. This was after the halo was off, and I really wasn't allowed to run yet. They said, no, you can't run yet. You don't tell a runner you can't run. Like, I gotta try.
Yeah.
And 20 steps, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm exhausted. It's terrible. But it was also motivating at the same time. It's like, okay, we're 40 next tomorrow, right? And then 80. And so let's double this up. And let's see how far I can push this. Because Rock and Roll Marathon's coming up in June, and I better be running it because I have a streak going on, and I'm not going to have this little bear thing stop me from that streak. So I focused basically on having to be able to run a marathon within, 6-7 months after the halo came off. Yep.
And you did it. I mean,
oh yeah,
most people can't run a marathon, period, let alone 10 months after a bear ripped up your body.
Yeah, and then I was disappointed with my time.
He ran it in 3 hours and 39 minutes.
I was disappointed with my time because I didn't qualify for Boston. And someone said to me, oh, come on, Otter. Reality, you're running. The fact that you're walking is wonderful, let alone that you just ran a marathon. What's your problem? It's like, okay, thank you. I needed that reality slap. It was interesting because the LA Marathon read around it. And they had invited me. They gave me their Courage Award, which was just so, so nice. But the other thing they did is they found a coach for me in San Diego to help me just get better, basically. And they totally helped me.
His next marathon was the St. George Marathon in St. George, Utah.
So it's a downhill marathon, but it starts at like 5,000 or 6,000 feet or something like that. So that's a whole different oxygen level. And they forget to tell you that there's a really steep uphill thing there too. And so I needed to be under 3:30, and I think I made it a 3:29. But the last mile, I was just like, oh no, I'm not driving back from St. George to San Diego not having qualified. I need to be able to make it. And I made it, which is just amazing. My wife, too, is like, oh, that's a relief. Otherwise, I had to sit with you and listen to you whine the whole time back home.
The effect running had on his mental health was well worth the pain.
I would say my running was one of the two biggest therapists I had. And the other therapist I had was that I actually volunteered and did some keynote speeches at big events. And just to force myself to talk about this, to cry in public. It's not easy.
Yeah.
To have the audience cry with you. It's healing. And I used that, and I've told audiences before too, it's like, you know, thank you so much for being as engaged as you are as an audience member, because it helps me able to talk about it, able to verbalize it, not just to you, but also to myself, really helps me to cope with this. Because it isn't easy, and what gets more difficult is that you pulled your daughter through something like this. I just start thinking about that. So the guilt didn't really happen right afterwards. The guilt happens later. Mm. You're like, why did I do this? And then you start realizing all the things that could have gone wrong but didn't go wrong. And you realize how much luck you had during that time as well.
Yeah.
Immense. And that whatever you did was the right thing because of the outcome. And so during my running, little bits became a reality. It's like the reality of the falls, which was pretty steep, set in. The reality of Jenna's fall, and that she didn't die during that fall, set in. And you're running, and you suddenly realize it, and you just stop running, and you go like, oh my gosh, this actually happened. And then you just focus, and you're trying to work through it in your own mind, basically. And running helped me with that, and presenting in front of audiences helped me with that as well.
Yeah.
And then to listen to the experience of other people. The audience was a therapist to me, and I was probably a therapist to so many members in the audiences that I talked to. I mean, I've had many grown men come to me, sort of crying about something that happened to them. And I remember this one guy said, I never cry. And he starts to cry. I'm like, don't worry. I just cried in public myself in front of all of you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. It must feel so validating to have all that like reflected back.
Yeah. Oh, and I've had people come to me, what do you say to that person? Like, what do you mean? She just thanked me, and I thanked her for being here. Oh my gosh, she just walked away crying. Then I found later on that either an uncle or a dad of hers had gotten killed by a bear before, and she had never talked about it. And it just things was just coming to the surface for people. It makes you really, it is good to talk about these things.
Johan's incredible story got a ton of media attention. He was even on the Today Show. But after a while, it felt like he and Jenna were losing control of their own story.
I mean, it was just kind of the start of the internet and social media and stuff like that. So you get some weird stuff too happening. And you're like, well, wait a minute. This is my story. This is not your story. And Jenna in particular, she was more sensitive to it. I think she said at one point, you know, Dad, they're making so much money out of our story. I don't want to do any of these interviews anymore. I just don't. I don't care. I said, yeah, you have a good point, right? And so we became incredibly selective in what we would do. But I'm like, you know, I need to get this out myself. And it's another way of coping in a way. And I need to write my own thing. And I think it's actually an uplifting story at the, mm-hmm. you know. And we are in need of uplifting stories. We always are as a society. You basically just sit down and you start and say, why do you start, right? I mean, of course, you start with the obvious, with the attack thing, and you're like, well, but it didn't just get there. There was life before that, too. Of course, my wife is incredible, and she helped. And since she's an English teacher, I mean, she's able to, oh, how's my grandma? Right? Which is probably terrible. So she helped me with that. And then I had a really good friend, Denise, who does this professionally. And I started writing it myself, and then we give it to her and say, can you look at this? And what do you think? Am I really getting to the essence of this or not? She was totally able to help me. She got me in contact with a publisher she had worked for. I was able to find someone that was willing to publish it. I mean, it costs money. It's not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's at least $10,000 that you have to put out yourself. And you hope that it sells enough books that you make that money back up again.
Johan's book, A Grisly Tale, A Father and Daughter Survival Story, was published in 2006.
It was very important to Johan to include the photos of his injuries in the book.
I put pictures in there purposely. And people say, you shouldn't do that, right? And actually, when I took it to the Park Service, they didn't want to put it in their shops either because of the pictures. And I said, you know, that's fine, but that's part of the story, right? I didn't want to add on to our previous belief that nothing's going to happen to you. No, stuff can really happen to you, and it can really go bad. And you really need to see that to get a good realization of, you know, how things can be, unfortunately. Maybe I'm too much of a realist, but I think that's important, though. And it's important for all of us, right? It's important to protect nature and the animals, and it's important for us as well from a safety perspective.
Jenna was just about to start college when this happened. And even after the attack, she still planned to pursue a career in dance.
And started dancing again. She's just an amazing dancer. Of course, being a dad, like, what are you going to do with dance in your career, right? It's like, can you do something in it? So she took science in addition to her dance, too. I think she got 1B in college because she couldn't get onto point in ballet and everything else was A's. But anyway, she graduated with a science degree and a bachelor's in fine arts and tried to break into dance in New York, didn't really work. And then, what about med school? So that's what she did after that. I know. And so she.
But med school's the fallback.
Interesting, right? And she got into Columbia and she did great, obviously. And she's now an ED physician and she's a toxicologist. So she's double boarded, which is pretty amazing.
Some of the reflecting Johan has done on the attack has been about how close he came to dying. But didn't.
Caitlin, it's basically I died, right? I could have so easily died.
Yeah.
You know, and having that, in a way, out-of-body kind of experience made me think, like, well, maybe I did die and maybe I didn't die. You know, it's one of these ways, because, I mean, the attack was incredible. It's the most violent thing you could possibly go through and still live through it.
Yeah.
But I also realized at that point is that death is actually, it's okay. It's actually a very gentle thing because, again, there's no pain. And it feels very peaceful. And it feels very like, I'm at peace, right? I'm okay with this. And since then, I've actually not been afraid of death anymore. Now, I don't want to die, obviously, right? Absolutely not. But that fear of death we all have, I don't have, because I know it's going to be really peaceful. And it's an okay thing, and it's a part of life.
Today, Johan is still living in San Diego, still working, and still getting up to run in what most people would call the middle of the night.
First of all, I have a fantastic job, still with the same company, obviously. Actually, I work with laboratorians right now, and with rehab services, my original field, which is pretty awesome. Jenna is a physician, married, love my son-in-law. They have a grandchild, so it's that's awesome. Noah is just amazing. And then my younger daughter has a fantastic boyfriend. They live together in Park City. And of course, my wife's just retired from teaching. I've lived the American dream, let's say it that way, because obviously I didn't, you know, I wasn't born in the United States. I was born in Holland. And yeah, I'm incredibly happy. And every year now I go hiking with Kim Justice, who's the helicopter pilot who saved us. And so besides physically doing great, I got so many more friends as a result of what happened to me. And you can take any story and make it a negative or make it a positive. Right? I don't live in the negative. I live in the positive. I'm just incredibly lucky. You know, I'm just lucky.
You can get Johan's book, A Grizzly Tale, A Father and Daughter Survival Story, wherever books are sold.
Last question. Do you miss your hair?
No. Initially, yes. But absolutely not. It's so easy. You never have a bad hair day. Never. Right? I just have to shave some of the patches that are still left, so it's perfectly bald. They did such a beautiful job with my head and reconstructing it. It's a medical piece of art. I would say it's like I'm showing a piece of art here, and I do have to get it protected during the day because I don't want sunshine to ruin it. No, I don't miss it at all.
I think baldness suits you.
Thank you.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoy today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.